when he called me I will answer when he calls to answer when he calls me, I will answer. I will be somewhere. I will be somewhere listening for my name.
That was Della Reese with Hush, Somebody's Calling My Name. And, of course, somebody is calling a name today, and the name is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. We commemorate the 86th birthday of Dr. King today with his prescient analyses of the amalgamated forces of oppression against people of color in the United States and worldwide, his redefinition of the struggle for freedom and equality in America, his relentless pursuit of justice through directed action, his application of the lessons of history, his undiluted pride in his culture and identity, and his unshakable faith. He transmits all this and more in his speeches today with vivid instructions to us all about the work still to be done to bring to fruition a just and democratic society. Mainstream media will play its predictable role today, projecting King as something of a dreamer. But Dr. King's blistering polemics, however, informed the thrust of the civil rights movement, which awakened society as a whole, and people of color especially, to their inherent power. King was a beacon, shining a strong light to bring us to safe harbor. Why, then, does it seem that we remain at anchor in a churning sea? Let's listen to Dr. King.
Is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality. And so today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. It's not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. And so as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, but Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today, the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. And as we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. And we see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. And so they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. And that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. And among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. And so you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now, the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us didn't see too well during the last 10 years, and that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insights, and the total flow of history. And the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved, innately impure, and innately inferior. And in the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. And he ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. And this is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, if one says that I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. And this is the great tragedy of it. I say that however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America. It's still deeply rooted in the North, and it's still deeply rooted in the South. Now, this leads me to say something about another discussion that we hear a great deal, and that is the so-called white backlash. And I would like to honestly say to you that the white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon. Not something that just came into being because shouts of black power, or because Negroes engaged in riots in Watts, for instance. The fact is that the state of California voted a fair housing bill out of existence before anybody shouted black power, or before anybody rioted in Watts. It may well be that shouts of black power and riots in Watts and the Harlems and the other areas are the consequences of the white backlash rather than the cause of them. What it is necessary to see is that there has never been a single solid monistic determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans. The whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. This is something that truth impels all men of goodwill to admit.
And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions, are appropriated for mass murder, but the most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos, but the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. The modest proposals for model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed. Thank you. It seems that our legislative assemblies have adopted Nero as their patron saint and are bent on fiddling while our cities burn. Even when the people persist and in the face of great obstacles develop indigenous leadership and self-help approaches to their problems, and finally tread the forest of bureaucracy to obtain existing government funds, the corrupt political order seeks to crush even this beginning of hope. The case of CDGM in Mississippi is the most publicized example, but it is a story repeated many times across our nation. Our own experience here in Chicago is especially painful at present. After an enthusiastic approval by HEW's Department of Adult Education, SCLC began an adult literacy project to aid 1,000 young men and women who have been pushed out of overcrowded ghetto schools in obtaining basically literacy skills prerequisite to receiving jobs. We had an agreement with A&P Stores for 750 jobs through SCLC's job program, Operation Breadbasket, and had recruited over 500 pupils the first week. At that point, Congressman Kuchinski and the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off our funds or channel them through the machine control poverty program in Chicago. Now we have no problem with administrative supervision, but we do have a desire to be independent of machine control and the Democratic Party patronage network. For this desire for a politically independent approach to the needs of our brothers, our funds are being stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of double talk when men in high places have a high blood pressure of deceptive rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We cry out against welfare handouts to the poor, but generously approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receive more than $1 million a year not to plant cotton, but no provision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. Crowning achievement in hypocrisy must go to those staunch Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West who were given land by our government when they came here as immigrants from Europe. They were given education through the land-grant colleges. They were provided with agricultural agents to keep them abreast of farming trends. They were granted low-interest loans to aid in the mechanization of their farms. And now that they have succeeded in becoming successful, they are paid not to farm. And these are the same people who now say to black people whose ancestors were brought to this country in chains and who were emancipated in 1863 without being given land to cultivate or bread to eat, that they must pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. what they truly advocate is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I wish that I could say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life. Certainly times of war, times of reaction throughout the society. But I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its very beginning. That is the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism. Not only is this our nation's dilemma, it is the plague of Western civilization. As early as 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. Now, as we stand two-thirds into this crucial period of history, we know full well that racism is still that hound of hell which dogs the tracks of our civilization. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves. A self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy, and a self in which she madly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence toward the Negro, causing America to take a step backward simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice. To be at once attracted to the Negro and repelled by him, to love and to hate him. And there has never been a solid, unified, and determined thrust to make justice a reality for Afro-Americans. The step backward has a new name today. It is called the white backlash. But the white backlash is nothing new. It is the surfacing of old prejudices, hostilities, and ambivalences that have always been there. It was caused neither by the cry of black power, nor by the unfortunate recent wave of riots in our cities. The white backlash of today is rooted in the same problem that has characterized America ever since the black man landed in chains on the shores of this nation. This does not imply that all white Americans are racist. Far from it. Many white people have, through a deep moral compulsion, fought long and hard for racial justice. Nor does it mean that America has made no progress in her attempt to cure the body politic of the disease of racism, or that the dogma of racism has not been considerably modified in recent years. However, for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality. While racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists, racism can well be that corrosive evil that will bring down the curtain on Western civilization. Arnold Toynbee has said that some 26 civilizations have risen upon the face of the earth. Almost all of them have descended into the junk heaps of destruction. The decline and fall of these civilizations, according to Toynbee, was not caused by external invasions, but by internal decay. They failed to respond creatively to the challenges impinging upon them. If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
Trying to make it through this barren land, but as I go from day to day, I can hear my Savior say, trust me, child, come home, I'll hold your hand.
I'm coming up
on the side,
on the outside,
on the mountain,
on the mountain, I must hold
to God's, His powerful hand,
His powerful hand.
I'm coming up on the rough side.
Trace Lead, host of Lead Stories. I'm proud to be part of the PRN family's hosts and the work that we do, promoting progressive ideas for inquiring minds. For the past 12 years, PRN has been advertisement-free and has never held a fundraiser. But the time has come to ask for your support. Won't you be a friend of PRN and commit to a monthly recurring donation of $20 or $50 or $75 or $100. This will help PRN continue its good work, bringing you the latest breaking stories and the best topics reported and discussed from a progressive point of view. Just go to PRN's homepage and click on the subscribe button. With each subscription, you will receive a free DVD from the Gary Null Library. Thank you for your support.
When the storm of life is raging, stand by me, love. When the storm of life is raging, yes, stand by me. When this world is tossing me just like a ship, oh yes, out on a sea. But Lord, you rule it. Yes, you do. The wind trees and the waters. Come on, come on, stand by me, love.
Stand.
And when I'm growing,
there are approximately 2,500,000,000 people in this world. The vast majority of them are colored people, just like you and me. They're colored people. About 1,600,000,000 of them live on two continents, Asia and Africa. 600,000,000 in China. 400,000,000 in India and Pakistan. 200,000,000 in Africa. 100,000,000 in Indonesia, more than 86 million in Japan. For years, most of these people have been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated and humiliated by some foreign power. And most of them have gained independence now. About 1,300,000,000 of these 1,600,000,000 people have their freedom and their independence today. Never forget that it wasn't given to them on a silver platter. It came through their struggles. It came through their persistent work. It came through their constant agitation. It wasn't handed out. We can learn something from that. I remember very vividly about a year ago having one of the great experiences of my life. Mrs. King and I had journeyed over to Africa to what was in the Gold Coast for the independence celebration. And I never will forget that night, about midnight, when about 100,000 people stood out in an open field in front of the House of Parliament. And at that moment, we watched an old flag come down. It was the Union Jack flag, and we watched a new flag going up. It was the flag of the new nation of God. A little black man mounted a platform by the name of Kwame Nkrumah. And he looked out across that vast crowd of people and said, "I declare to you that our nation is now independent and a free nation." When he declared that, I looked out. My ears were open and I could hear black boys and black girls, old men and old women crying, "Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!" At that moment, tears began to flow from my eyes. To my right was standing my wife and Ralph Bunch, and to my left was standing Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, and as I looked around at them, I saw tears rolling from their eyes. This was a great moment. Then I looked over to Adam Powell and said, "Adam, this means something. This represents something. We must never forget, something that we must take home. It should remind us that freedom is a costly thing, and it never comes without suffering and sacrifice. We must never forget." That little black man who mounted that platform had on a little cap. And it was a cap that he had worn for months and months while in prison. He went to jail for that freedom. We must never forget that hundreds of people spilled their blood on the shores of this nation. They are free today. They are free today. They suffered and sacrificed for that freedom. Went to jail for it, and some of them died for it. Nehru is now a great man in this world, leading the second most populous nation in the world. Nehru spent years of his life in British jails. Mahatma Gandhi spent years of his life in British jails. We must never forget this lesson of history.
I know.
Now, I'm afraid that some of us are forgetting this. We feel that it is just going to roll in on the wheels of inevitability, and so we sit down by the wayside and do nothing.
I know.
It doesn't happen that way. Years ago, a man lived in England by the name of Darwin, and he developed what is known as the theory of evolution. But Darwin's theory applied only to the biological realm, and he conceived the man biologically as moving up from some type of animal existence now to his present state of personality. But that was another man who lived in England who had read the works of Darwin, and he tried to apply this concept to the whole of society. And so men came to believe that progress was inevitable.
Yes.
Somehow men felt that things are just evolving to a better state, and so you don't have to do anything. They'll just want to do it anyway.
Yes.
But history has proven that that just isn't true.
Yes.
Human progress is never inevitable.
No.
It only comes through the tireless work and persistent efforts of dedicated individuals. It's not a process of sitting down waiting. You got to do something about it.
No matter where you are today, somebody helped you to get there. In a larger sense, we've got to see this in our world today. Our white brothers must see this. They haven't seen it up to now. Great problem facing our nation today in the area of race is that it is the black man who, to a large extent, produced the wealth of this nation. And the nation doesn't have sense enough to share its wealth and its power with the very people who made it so. I know what I'm talking about this morning. The black man made America wealthy. That's why I tell you right now, I'm not going anywhere. They can talk, these groups, some people talking about a separate state. Go back to Africa. I love Africa. It's our ancestral home. I don't know about you. My grandfather and my great-grandfather did too much to build this nation for me to be talking about getting away from it. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, in 1620, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They've made cotton kings. With their hands and with their backs and with their labor, they built the study docks, the stout factories, the impressive mansions of the South. Now this nation is telling us that we can't build. Negroes are excluded almost absolutely from the building trades. It's lily white. Why? Because these jobs pay $6, $7, $8, $9, and $10 an hour, and they don't want Negroes to have it. And I fear that if something doesn't happen soon, and something massive, the same indictment will come to America. Buy food. That man said he didn't know what to do with his goods. He had so many. Oh, I wish I could have advised him. A lot of places to go, and there were a lot of things that could be done. There were hungry stomachs that needed to be filled. There were empty pockets that needed access to money. And America today, my friends, is also rich in goods. We have our bonds, and every day our rich nation is building new and larger and greater bonds. You know, we spend millions of dollars a day to store surplus food. But I want to say to America, I know where you can store that food free of charge. In the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children in Asia and Africa and South America and in our own nation who go to bed hungry at night. There are a lot of fools around because they fail to realize their dependence on others. Finally, this man was a fool because he failed to realize his dependence on God. Do you know that man talked like he regulated the seasons? That man talked like he gave the rain to grapple with the fertility of the soil. That man talked like he provided the dew. He was a fool because he ended up acting like he was the creator. Instead of a creature. This man-centered foolishness is still alive today. You know, a lot of people are forgetting God. People just get involved in other things. I tell you this morning, my friend, there's no way to get rid of him. One day, you're going to need him. The problems of life will begin to overwhelm you. Disappointments will begin to beat upon the door of your life like a tidal wave. And if you don't have a deep and patient faith, you aren't going to be able to make it. I know this from my own experience. I grew up in the church. I'm the son of a preacher. I'm the great-grandson of a preacher. And the great-great-grandson of a preacher. My father is a preacher. My grandfather was a preacher. My great-grandfather was a preacher. My only brother is a preacher. My daddy's brother is a preacher. So I didn't have much choice, I guess. But I had grown up in the church, and the church meant something very real to me, but it was a kind of inherited religion, and I had never felt an experience with God in the way that you must have it if you're going to walk the lonely paths of this life. One day, after finishing school, I was called to a little church down in Montgomery, Alabama. A year later, a lady by the name of Rosa Parks decided that she wasn't going to take it any longer. She stayed on a bus seat. You may not remember it because it's way back now, several years, but it was the beginning of a movement where 50,000 black men and women refuse absolutely to ride the city buses, and we walked together for 381 days.
Yes, sir.
That's what we got to learn in the North. The Negroes have to learn to stick together. We stuck together. We sent out the call. No Negro rode the buses. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. People of Montgomery asked me to serve as the spokesman. And as the president of the new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, that came into being to lead the boycott, I couldn't say no. And then we started our struggle together. Things were going well for the first few days, but then about 10 or 15 days later, after the white people in Montgomery knew that we meant business, they started doing some nasty things. They started making nasty telephone calls, and it came to the point that some days more than 40 telephone calls would come in, threatening my life, the life of my family, the life of my children. I took it for a while in a strong manner. But I never will forget one night very late. It was around midnight. And you can have some strange experiences at midnight. The telephone started ringing and I picked it up. On the other end was an ugly voice. That voice said to me in substance, "Nigger, we are tired of you and your mess now. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house." I'd heard these things before, but for some reason that night it got to me. I turned over and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't sleep. I was frustrated, bewildered. And then I got up and went back to the kitchen and I started warming some coffee, thinking that coffee would give me a little relief. Then I started thinking about many things. I pulled back on the theology and philosophy that I had just studied in the universities, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence and the reality of sin and evil. But the answer didn't quite come there. I sat there and thought about a beautiful little daughter who had just been born about a month earlier. We have 4 children now, but we only had 1 then. She was the darling of my life. I'd come in night after night and see that little gentle smile. And I sat at that table thinking about that little girl and thinking about the fact that she could be taken away from any minute. And I started thinking about a dedicated, devoted, and loyal wife who was over there asleep. She could be taken from me, I could be taken from her. And I got to the point that I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. And something said to me, "You can't call on Daddy now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't even call on Mama now. You got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about. That power that can make a way out of no way." I discovered then that religion had to become real to me and I had to know God for myself. And I bowed down over that cup of coffee. I never will forget it. Oh, yes, I prayed a prayer, and I prayed out loud that night. I said, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But, Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And I can't let the people see me like this, because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they will begin to get weak. It seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world. I tell you, I've seen the lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roll. I felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. No, never alone. No, never alone. He promised never to leave me. Never to leave me alone. I'm going on in believing in him. You better know him and know his name. Know how to call his name. Don't be a fool. Recognize your dependence on God. Centuries ago, Jeremiah raised the question, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? He raised it because he saw the good people suffering so often and the evil people prospering.
Yes.
Centuries later, our slave foreparents came along. They too saw the injustices of life and had nothing to look forward to morning after morning but the rawhide whip of the overseer. Long rolls of cotton and the sizzling heat. But they did an amazing thing. They looked back across the centuries and they took Jeremiah's question mark and straightened it into an exclamation point. They could sing, there is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. And there's another stanza that I like so well. Sometimes I feel discouraged. And I don't mind telling you this morning that sometimes I feel discouraged. I felt discouraged in Chicago. As I moved through Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, I feel discouraged. Living every day under the threat of death, I feel discouraged sometimes. Living every day under extensive criticisms, even from Negroes, I feel discouraged sometimes. Yes, sometimes I feel discouraged and feel my works in vain. But then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul.
You just stand. You just stand.
Just